Hello and welcome to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the people involved in our public conversations, what they hold sacred, and what they've learned about dealing with difference. Every episode, I speak to someone with some kind of public voice, from novelists to journalists, archbishops to artists, politicians to philosophers, and ask them about the ideas that have shaped them, with the aim of helping us really understand where people are coming from, even if we disagree with them. In this episode, I spoke to Samir Rahim. Samir is managing editor for art and books at Prospect Magazine, and has been a judge for the Costa Poetry Book Prize, the Forward Prize for Poetry, and the Orwell Prize for Nonfiction. He's also the author of Asghar and Zahra, a novel about a young couple born into the same British Muslim community and their first year of marriage. We spoke about his religious childhood, loving his time studying English literature at Cambridge, his evolving Muslim faith, and why the true history of our religions will always be just out of reach. I really hope you enjoy listening. Samir, I would love to ask you the big meaty question about your sacred values, what you hold sacred. And I've sort of given up trying to explain what I mean, because it does feel slightly like something beyond words, and also because it gives you space to fill that word with kind of what it means to you. You've had a bit of warning. What came to mind?
Struggled with this one. In the end, I came up with truthfulness. I suppose not truth, because it seems a little bit too certain. Truthfulness maybe is an attempt to get at what we most think of as most important, and what is real. Funnily enough, as a novelist, you're writing fiction, so it's all made up. But the best fiction is the kind that really digs down into the deepest, most hidden, mysterious parts of yourself. Mm. Not quite truth, because I think truth is something that we should always aspire to move towards, to try and understand, try and get towards. The love of truth is the faintest of all human passions, said A.E. Housman. Wow. And that's, I think that's very true in some senses. We're always trying to get towards it, but it's so easy to be lost under a sort of a welter of self-deception. I was always thinking also about, the idea of truth in the Quran is quite interesting. There's a phrase that talks about how the truthful will be questioned about their truth. And it refers to the prophets. So Abraham and Jesus in Islamic pantheon, and Muhammad as well. Even these most truthful of people will be questioned about their truth. And the idea that the most perfected beings on earth, who, according to the Quran's theology, are also people who are going to be questioned as well.
Mm. And do you have an instinct about where that comes from in you?
I don't know. I think most people have that. I could relate it to my own upbringing in some ways. Perhaps it's to do with being Muslim, growing up with this idea of truth. I grew up in London, in West London, in a rather boring suburb, and there were sort of multiple worlds that I lived in. I had the sort of world of school that everyone goes to, and the world of television, which I watched a lot. Later on, the world of books. There was also this alternative life where I was educated in studying Arabic and studying the Quran. Tuesday evening was tafsir, exegesis, which I studied with a lady in Harrow. Saturday was Arabic class in Ealing. And Sunday was madrasa, basically Sunday school, in Harrow. And for me, it was all perfectly normal. At the same time, there was a sense in which we were doing something that felt quite secretive, or that people didn't really know what we were doing or anything about us. The madrasa, the Sunday school we had, was actually held in a proper school that during the week was a girls' school. And it was always tickled me, the fact that all these people who were going to the school wouldn't realize that on a Sunday, the landscape of the school would be transformed with lots of girls wearing hijabs and boys wearing our little skull caps when we did the prayers, and the sense in which we were this sort of hidden world. This was the 1990s, where people didn't really have any interest in Muslims.
And your school wasn't a Muslim school, so there was it sounds like it was different from your day-to-day life. Was it
mixed? No, I didn't go to Muslim school. Went to a grammar school in High Wycombe, which was quite an interesting mixed area. Quite a lot of Pakistani students there. But again, people didn't really know anything about Islam or really think very much about it. You look back on it as a sort of golden age in some ways, where it wasn't exposed to the idea of the public Muslim or having to represent yourself in some way. Mm. Even the word for us going to madrasa on a Sunday was just something that you did. Of course, post 9/11, even the word madrasa can't be mentioned on TV without saying someone else following it up with, after attending one, he went to blow himself up or something like that. So even the word suddenly becomes this sort of slightly sinister, odd thing. Whilst for me, it's got a sort of homely and quite sort of comforting associations. That sort of double meaning of things I find quite interesting.
Yeah. And in the home, how did... what were the ideas in the air there? Were your parents very devout? Were they politically involved? What was the kind of atmosphere in which the little Samir grew up in?
I'd say they were both devout and sort of relaxed at the same time, in the sense that we got a lot of freedom to do what we wanted to do, read what we wanted to read. But, you know, it was definitely taken as read that, you know, prayers happen at a certain time. And my father was two things. He was a physicist, he was a scientist, and he was also a preacher. He moved to this country in 1962 from Zanzibar, which is a small island off the coast of East Africa. You may well know that, but I was standing in line the other day at the bank, and somebody was talking about the safari they were going on. And they said, oh, we're going to this place called Zanzibar. Never heard of it. Well, it was ruled by the British for many years and the Omanis. So he emerged from there, but there's not many places you can study physics in Zanzibar, a tiny place. So he moved to Portsmouth to do his A-levels. At that time, there was a revolution in Zanzibar, and which meant he never, he couldn't go back for a long time.
Wow.
So, in fact, we went back in 1999, and he showed me around all the places that he'd visited. His father was a scholar and a preacher, as well as being a policeman and then a judge later on. So he was fluent in Arabic and Persian. He wrote a dictionary of the Quran. He was also, a loyal servant of the British Empire. And we were part of this sort of weird East African Indian community, which was a sort of intermediate class that got certain benefits from being close to the British, which disappeared when the British left.
Right. I feel like I want to... That's a whole other podcast we could talk about, Zanzibar and the diaspora. Anyway, so you went on to study English at Cambridge, and it almost feels like a bit of a cliche asking this question, but I was reading an article in the Times very recently still about how basically non-white students at Oxford and Cambridge still feel a huge amount of kind of cultural dislocation in lots of places. So kind of forgive me for asking the question, but I wanted to ask, how was your experience at Cambridge? And there's also, I think, some justification because the novel that we'll talk about, there's a character who goes to Cambridge and is wrestling through lots of those themes of belonging and identity.
I had a fantastic time at Cambridge. I absolutely loved it. For me, it felt like emerging into another world. I'd say by the time I was 16 or 17, I'd had a lot of religion in my life. And it wasn't as such that I made a conscious decision to abandon it. It was more like I was started to be interested in different things, and that was really mainly English literature. And going to a place where everyone else was obsessed with English literature and wanted to talk about it and wanted to study it and think about it was a revelation for me. I had also what I think could be euphemistically called a sheltered upbringing. So going to Cambridge was an eye-opening place for me. Of course, other people thought it was incredibly dead and square, and I'm sure it was in comparison to other universities. But yeah, there's all the kinds of things that you have to negotiate. You have to decide where the limits of your own religious practice lie, whether you're still interested in that. I used to go and explore in the library for... certain texts which weren't freely available that I'd heard about. There was this books which were, you know, revisionist histories of Islamic past, which
I'm now imagining a kind of Hogwarts restricted section equivalent, but I'm sure they were only available there.
Well, I got into it through the Satanic Verses and Salman Rushdie, really.
Like a gateway drug.
Yeah, yeah. So it was funny with Rushdie because, you know, I very clearly remember the demonstrations against that. And although I don't think any of my family members went on them, I knew people who did and people who rung up radio stations to complain about him. So by the time I was 15 or 16, I was like, I really have to read this book. And eventually I wrote a dissertation on it at Cambridge, trying to investigate the historical sources that Rushdie uses, the incidence of the Satanic Verses as a historical fact or not, why Muslims believed that the incident of the Satanic Verses was true for about 200 years, and then it suddenly faded from fashion. And all those questions were bubbling away. But mostly I was just, you know, wrestling with Milton and Shakespeare like everyone else.
This is quite self-indulgent, as regular listeners will know. I am also an English graduate and poetry lover. And I wanted to ask about words, because you studied English literature and then you went on to work for Oxford English Dictionaries. Is that right? And then you've reviewed books and written your books. And underneath this podcast is a kind of theme around public conversation and public debate. And implicit in that is the words we use with each other in public and the way they form us. Tell me if you can, what is the pull towards spending your life with words, and how do you think they've kind of shaped you?
Well, my job, which was really a summer job at the OED, was going through the 2,000 or so words that derive from Arabic and Persian, and checking and updating the definitions. That in itself was quite fascinating, because you all sorts of odd things come up. Admiral apparently is from Turkish.
Wow. And so it's like etymology detective work.
Meanings, you know, what, and you're digging into the past, using a word to dig into the past. It's a sort of historical analysis. There was also a library there which was full of novels, you would have to go through a novel and underline new words that had appeared in the language.
Wow.
Now, what counts as a new English word? Well, if the word was in italics in the novel, then it was identifying itself as a foreign word. But if it wasn't in italics, it was saying, this is part of the English language. This is part of English literature.
The readers are going to understand it enough that we can just let it lie without explaining it.
Exactly. One of the words whose definition I worked on was wuzu, W-U-Z-U, which is the sort of ablution that Muslims undertake before they pray or touch the Quran, usually. And I wrote the definition for that, and I keep on checking, but it hasn't yet gone in, because apparently it's still a foreign word. For me, it was a very sort of common word as I was growing up. So when I came to write my own novel, one thing I was very sure of was that I wasn't going to italicize any of the words that the characters used, which were completely normal to them, because for me it wasn't a foreign word, for them it wasn't a foreign word. So maybe I can nudge the editors of the OED and they can sort of resurrect that definition.
You've written a whole novel as a piece of evidenced argument for your original employers. Look.
That's one of the main motivations for writing it, yes. Yeah.
That is amazing. There's so many threads I want to pick up, but so tell me, what were you following in that career trajectory? Kind of what is the motivation for you to be pursuing the jobs that you pursued? What is it that's animating you underneath?
Well, I wanted to do something to do with literature, because it's what I enjoyed. And I wanted to do something that was instantaneously gratifying. So writing a review, which comes out the next week or the next couple of weeks, is a bit more, get more of an instant hit. The first meeting of the OED we had, we said, well, the next edition is coming out in 2037 or something.
Word.
So now, of course, they have sort of online every quarter and all the rest of it. And also sort of quite omnivorous. I just quite like new books, exploring different arenas, getting into different historical periods. I started off reviewing a lot of fiction, and I do less of that now, and I tend to do more ideas, Middle Eastern history and all the rest of it. My 20s, I sort of, you know, as I said, I'd had kind of enough of Middle Eastern-y, Islamic, Indian-y stuff, and I was really exploring the English side of my identity and the great history of English literature, and that was what I was most interested in. When I turned 30, as happens with these things, they stay dormant for a while and then they come back. I started to, really, people start questioning you about things. Mm. You know, I worked at the Daily Telegraph, and one of maybe two Muslims in the entire office. So when questions arise, you get asked about them. People have very firm opinions about things, which you sort of think aren't true, and you think, but you don't quite know the answer. Mm. So it's a motivation for you to go to the library and find things out. And I discovered that there was another way of approaching religion and religious culture than the one that I'd been brought up with, something that was a little bit more expansive. You know, there's an artistic tradition, there's a sort of literary tradition, again, bringing together the threads of what I've been examining.
It always feels almost as private as asking someone about their sex life, so forgive me. But through that time, what did your kind of lived experience of Islam look like? Were you practicing? Was it more of a kind of internal reflecting on what you believed and why?
It was always there. I'd say the volume was turned down a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say that I don't ever say that I ever quite lost my faith, but I've certainly sort of, it's been revivified. But I've come to a different place than, you know, I could never return to, I suppose, not even, you know, it was a world, I look at my teenage world a little bit like certain people regard the pre-Reformation past. You know, there's a sort of sense that this was a pre-lapsarian period where no one could even think of being an atheist because it was just the air that you breathed. It was just always there. And then only when people started doubting did true belief come through and you had to sort of attach yourself to something. I'm sure that's got its own kind of mythical version as well. But I think for me, I get a lot of sustenance from looking at how other Muslims in history have interpreted their faith and how they're trying to interpret it now, particularly in the artistic and literary realms.
Yeah. Let's talk about your novel. And have you always been writing fiction on the side? How did it come about?
I've been writing this book for 10 years, and it's quite a short book. So that tells you that I'm very slow. But also it tells me that I needed to work out who I was in some ways before I could actually write this book. I needed to go through some of the experiences that the characters had. When I started writing this book, I was single. And by the time I ended it, I was married. So perhaps, you know, the sort of marriage scenes in there were helped, although my wife would hasten to want me to add very quickly that this isn't about us at all. Also, I started writing this in my late 20s, and the characters, though, were, you know, 18, 19 and 21, 22. And I'm 10 years older now, so I even have it feels very distant in some ways. Yeah, I'd always wanted to write fiction. I was, a reviewing life or writing about other books, the I is never present for me. I'm not a confessional writer in my public works particularly. And I felt that there was an awful lot that I wanted to say and that could be said and wasn't really being said. And I could just pour all of that into a novel because you can give characters opinions that you sort of had or you maybe had at one point and then gave other characters the opposing point of view and enter into a dialogue without having to be held account for any of it.
Yeah. I'm going to dive into some of the themes in it, but first I want to ask about writing about faith in general, because the novel is in some ways it's not about religion at all, it's about a marriage, it's about two people, but they're embedded in a community and one of the points of tensions between them is their different ways of practicing Islam and their different self-understandings. And I have this kind of ongoing, you know, background argument with myself about why it's so difficult to write about Christianity in novels, particularly now when you had a kind of golden age, I guess, although it probably didn't feel like that and was spread out with kind of big Russian novelists and themes coming through. But in the 20th century, it all gets a bit, you know, quiet. And I always think of Graham Greene and Marilynne Robinson and then you sort of run out. and I'm sure there's others I haven't discovered, but I go round and round in this. Is it that you just can't F the ineffable? You know, is it that the experience of encounter with the transcendent is so internal that it is one of the things that words can't hold. But then I feel like human love or parenting or various other experiences are fairly transcendent as well. And there's lots written about those. So tell me, is there a great tradition of Islamic novels that you were drawing on? And how did you find the experience of at least peripherally writing about faith?
Wow, that's an interesting question. So I'd say there's a lot of religion in the book. There's not that much about God. And perhaps that's because of the difficulties that you just described. Religion, I find, in a way, is perfectly suited to treatment in a novel because it's to do with the odd little practices people have. It's to do with texts that people can draw on. So Oscar in the book is constantly thinking about, you know, stories about the prophet's life that he can draw on. I suppose, taking your question back to front, what is the original literary nature of Islam? So you've got the Quran, which most people know about, you know, revealed to the prophet, you know, set in stone. Then you have all the interpretations. Of it, but also you have all these stories about the prophet's life, mainly formulated either by storytellers who knew something about him, you know, quite a few years after he died, but also for legal purposes, little stories, you know, what did the prophet do in this situation? So somebody would ask him and then it was recorded down. There's, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these stories. Often they're mutually contradictory. What is actually true and what is not true is a point of contention, both for Muslims and for sort of modern scholars. Jesus, I think it's fair to say, didn't say very much. It's pretty much all there. But Muhammad said so much. Mm. And so for me, it's a strength to a religion because it shows the flexibility. You can carve a path. You can carve a path of a Muhammad, as it were, as a model that can say almost anything, not quite anything, but almost anything. So Oscar certainly, who's sort of the more traditionally religious of the two, well, certainly thinks it's more important when he's, you know, looking for guidance on marriage or, you know, what to do on your wedding night. He explores these hadith, these stories about the prophet's life. And of course, if you look it up, as you can do now very easily, there are, you know, advice about how to behave on your wedding night and what to do. And I took deliberately the, for me, the most entertaining and outre stories about that, just because I felt like, well, they exist, and so why can't I use them? Yes, in terms of Muslim novelists, poetry has been really the big literary tradition in the Islamic world, and mainly in the sort of Persian and Indo-Persian world. Sa'di is a 11th century Persian writer. Well, these wonderful sort of folk tales drawing on prophetic stories and other traditions. Rumi, of course, you know, well known in the West for his slightly simplified version, you might say, but the Masnavi, which is his great text, is just a collection of stories, really, again, about prophets and jinns. It's a bit like the Arabian Nights, but with a sort of religious tinge. In the 20th century, running forward, you know, great novelists like Ahmad Ali, who wrote, I think, in the 30s and 40s, he was an Indian and then later Pakistani writer, wrote a book called Twilight in Delhi. That was a real sort of model for me. But, you know, as my editor told me when I had it in the book, this is really in formal style an English comedy. Hmm. It just happens to be that the characters are Muslim.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Zara. And now, because you said you pronounced it two ways in the book, I've now got stuck.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So Zara or Zahra. Yeah. And different audiences say different things. And, of course, how she actually pronounces her own name.
We don't know.
You know, so some people call her... I think she probably calls herself, anglicize herself to Zara. Okay. But people who want to be more sort of accurately Arabic will call her Zahra.
Right.
But of course, the third layer of that is that that's a sort of Arabization of her name.
Right.
And in fact, the closer pronunciation to where my, you know, her Indian and parents and grandparents would be more Zara. Okay. So the hard H is for the sort of slightly pretentious Arabized Muslim who thinks things are only authentic if they're actually Arab.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, then I feel much better about
the answer to that is anything you
okay.
want, really.
The character whose name begins with a Z goes, we kind of meet her when she's graduated from Cambridge, but a lot of her kind of self-reflection seems to be this tension she feels between the kind of belonging of her community. And I think it feels like that's one of the things that draws her to Asker, that he is a sense of home, a sense of someone who understands everything that she's grown up with. And then on the other hand, at Cambridge, this kind of pull of a cosmopolitan, globalized intellectual milieu, and this sense of the thing that really stuck with me is she talks about having to kind of argue with the older white male Don at Cambridge, almost about identity in Islam through the lens of Shakespeare. And Asghar says, Shakespeare is their Quran. And, you know, that it feels so right that there is something sacred in that intellectual milieu. It's just not the Bible or the Quran, or maybe it's a bit the Bible and a bit the Quran, but it's mainly Shakespeare. And all the way through the book, you see this tension between Zahra's sense of the world has been opened up to her, but she also feels destabilized by that, and the pull towards home and belonging and wanting to call her husband out of it, kind of up to her level, but then realizing as time goes on that maybe she's lost something. I'm just, terribly cheesy question, but how autobiographical is that struggle, and where are you now with it? Assuming that it is, I'll answer my own question.
Well, the specific incident you talk about with Shakespeare is autobiographical. So I think, I gave her that experience that I had when I went for my interview at Cambridge. So I was trying to work out, you know, what would be the most appealing thing for someone who interviewed me to think about. And I went for one interview where the person interviewing me didn't really want to talk about Shakespeare or literature at all. They just wanted to talk about who I was and my identity and all the rest of it, which I found a little bit discomforting in some ways.
Was it a kind of do you fit here vibe?
No, it was more like, oh, it must be terribly difficult for you kind of vibe, which I find
quite patronizing.
But there was a little other part of me, and that part of me I gave to Zahra, which is the quite cynical sense of, well, I mean, how am I able to explain this? And I had memorized a few passages of Shakespeare, and one was Shylock's speech, famous speech. And I recited it for him, and I could just see him sort of saying, yes, he gets it, you know, because he gets it because, you know, he's going to challenge us, but not too much. You know, we can do it through the medium of that. And suppose I found that she, I gave it to her. She's not studying English, so I had to sort of do a bit of a bit of maintenance on the plot in that way. So I made her play Jessica, who is Shylock's daughter in The Merchant of Venice, and sort of the speech absorbed it. Of course, Jessica is one of those figures who abandons her faith to go and marry a Christian, and that so there's a parallel there. So yes, I loved Shakespeare, but it's also great literature can be in this sort of funny way instrumentalized to become a sort of an embodiment of liberal values that we can all agree on. And I suppose I wanted to take her down a peg or two, because she comes to the limits of what she feels she can do. Mm. And people push themselves to a certain point and they realize, you know, they will do some kind of violation to themselves if they push further than that. Mm. And I think the word violation is necessary there. So in this sense, it's more of a sort of romantic or sexual encounter, which is ambiguous and doesn't go as she wishes. And I feel at that point, she feels like she has to retreat back into herself and makes a quite hasty decision to marry Asghar. She does it because she likes him, but also she feels like he's going to be a sort of audience for her. She's going to be performing her own her own Englishness to him. Mm. And she doesn't quite respect him or treat him as well as she should. And that's partly why the marriage takes a bad turn.
Yeah. I'm kind of grasping, I can't frame it very well into a question, but I'm grasping towards this sense of one of the threads we set around a lot is tribalism and belonging, and how we make those encounters with people who we don't naturally feel at home with more humane and productive and fruitful rather than just continually being kind of kicked into these fight or flight defensive mechanisms that we're seeing kind of played out en masse in society. And one of the things that we do at Theos is we feel like we are translators across tribes often. And I spend, you know, deliberately much more time talking to people who aren't Christians than I do Christians. And find myself doing some of what Zara does, that kind of thinking, right, who is my audience? What do they need to know about me in order to trust me enough? You know, what are the signifiers? I used to do it all the time on Thought for the Day. I stopped doing Thought for the Day for various reasons. But for a while I did it and it felt like I need to say something smart that the audience doesn't already know or that they're not expecting from a religious person. So they go, oh, yeah, that's sensible. And then I need to do something that's kind of emotionally resonant. And then maybe people will trust me enough that what I'm going to say about theology isn't complete nonsense. But if you don't do the groundwork, then people will switch you off immediately. But I do feel that tension sometimes. And I think everyone does whose part of their calling is to cross boundaries or to be away from their tribe, of what's kind of appropriate chameleoning and what's undermining of identity, and that that pull back and forth. It feels to me like Zara, it's very unresolved for her at the end. Do you get a sense of where the story goes afterwards?
Well, she's perpetually translating herself, and that's what we as a British Muslim, you sort of have to do, particularly in the public space, you know, because you've got two things. One, you know, you've got this thing called religion, which people are, oh, well, what's that thing? You know? Plus, then you've got this, you know, it's Islam. So it's just this freighted other with all the kind of tensions that comes with. And I suppose in this book, I wanted to try and give people a glimpse of some of the internal debates that people have. Yeah. So actually, I feel that this book... It's not trying to explain out in the same way. And actually, there's a lot of explanations I took out of the book, and I said people will just need to get on with it for themselves, because Muslims themselves are self-conflicted about these things. There's one scene which I think is maybe emblematic towards the beginning, where Oscar and Zara are on their honeymoon, and they're in the Cordoba Cathedral, or is it a mosque? And it's this wonderful space where... But again, very, very tense. So it's been a cathedral for 800 years, and it's a very impressive building. And before then, it was a mosque, and it still has the Umayyad red and white banded palm tree columns in there. It's incredibly beautiful, but it's also very strange. Mm-hmm. And when they go there, they have very different reactions to it. And for Oscar, you know, the legacy of Muslim Spain and the glories of it and all the rest of it become this sort of point of identity. So he can project his own discomfort with being in Britain and being a British Muslim onto this historical conflict that existed hundreds of years ago. And in a way, that's a sort of seed of extremism, in the sense that if you try and project your own difficulties onto this sort of trans-historical wealth, we've been oppressed for hundreds of years, blah, blah, blah. Zara takes a slightly different view. She says, well, it is just sort of history, you know, there's and, you know, well, how did these places become Muslim in the first place? Something must have happened. What was that? You know, the history of the world is one of invasions and taking things apart and people using other people's buildings. And why I wanted to set the scene there is because, in a sense, they are both cathedrals and mosques at the same time. You know, they are, and to allow the space to be both, to feed both sides of themselves, I think is the absolutely necessary part. Because if you try and cut one off, if you try and just to try and define it in one way, everything else will get too sort of clouded and congested. There'll be a sort of self-denying. And I firmly believe that when you cut yourself off from your spiritual, intellectual roots and cultural roots, when you don't make the effort to explore the fact that, yes, there's Shakespeare, but there's also great literature in the Islamic tradition. There are great stories. There's a lot of sustenance there. Then that leads to the curdling of a tradition into an identity. It then becomes a weapon to be wielded. It then becomes something that you support rather than something that you explore and question and add to and subtract and all the rest of it. So it's unresolved at the end for Zara, and indeed in some ways for Uska as well. But I think it's good that it's not resolved, because we're perpetually in conversation about these things.
Mm. Feels the older I get, the more the kind of both and thinking as a just part of growing up feels like learning to live in those tensions and learning to find kind of internal stability while you balance on all these fault lines, really. And that, yeah, the resisting the urge of certainty and hermetically sealed identities and something I'm still working on. Tell me a little bit about The Shadow of the Scroll, this essay that you wrote about Islam's origins, because it's interesting. You've spoken to Tom Holland, and I've spoken to Tom Holland here, who is this figure who is become emblematic, but it's only of a much broader kind of scholarly movement around looking at how the Quran came together and the kind of early historical record around Islam. And you've written very carefully and very thoughtfully, just kind of laying out where the debate is, but also kind of broadly supportive of people like Tom and others, saying using kind of modern historical techniques or archaeology or whatever is appropriate to explore the origins of Islam is kind of valid and should be welcomed by Muslims. I remember the kind of furore around the program coming out on Channel 4. I'd love to just hear your journey with it and where you think that conversation around Islam and Islam's origins and how it plays into the fact we're in quite a moment where it feels like Islamophobia is on the rise and there's always this instinct to kind of be protective because things can be put into the wrong hands and used in the wrong way and cause harm. I've just laid out a load of tensions that I'm sure you spend years thinking about.
So where did it start for me? Probably back at Cambridge, when I should have been doing my proper work. I was looking at a book called Hagerism by Patricia Crone and Michael Cook, which was published, I think, in the mid-70s, around the time that Ibn Said's Orientalism came out, actually, the interesting parallel texts. And that book was a sort of a polemic in many ways, but it exploded some of the more comfortable assumptions within the Western academy, forget about the Muslim world, about the historicity of the Prophet's life, and also they didn't quite touch on it there, but implicitly the Quran. So in a way, there is a parallel to what happened in the mid-19th century and the search for the historical Jesus and that movement. And, you know, what did Jesus actually say? Can we submit
kind
this
textual
to
textual criticism?
Textual criticism. What is the actual evidence? And it's a bringing to bear of modern sort of scientific or quasi-scientific methods. Now, two interesting things came out of that. So let's take the Quran, first of all. So the idea that the Quran was a melange put together 200 years after the Prophet's death and various Christian hymns was a theory put forward in the 1970s. Since then, discovery of Quranic texts, in fact, in the Sana'a Mosque in Yemen, in a bunch of Hessian sacks, which have been dated to, you know, 650 to 670, with tiny variants on the text that we have now, but really nothing especially significant.
So kind of parallel to if people know about the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery, yeah. A sense in which, oh, wow, things are a lot older and a lot more accurate than we thought they were.
Yeah, and the Quran certainly definitely seems to have been fixed in something like its final form within about 20 or 30 years of the Prophet's death. And in fact, if you read it as a book, you can understand that it feels like a book that, how can I put it? If they'd waited 100 or 200 years, it would have been a lot easier to understand. They would have translated it into their into the idiom of later years. Its mystery and its sacredness is something is to do with its the difficulties of understanding what it actually means. The stories about the Prophet's life are something slightly different, and I think Muslims have always been skeptical about stories of the Prophet's life. One of the jobs of these collectors of hadith, about 200 years, 150, 200 years after the prophet's death, was to go around and finding all these stories about him and what are true, what is not true. And they developed this science where it'd be like, well, there's an oral tradition which was then told to this person, told to this person, and told to this person. And so modern scholars are like, well, of course, that doesn't really add up. And what we need to do is look at things like coins and epigraphs. And I think this is a fascinating subject, really. And why it's interesting is the question that Tom Holland asks and other historians ask is why so little was written down about the prophet in the earliest years? If he was this incredibly important person, why didn't they immediately write things down? The reason, I think, was because there was a Quran. And in the Quran, addressed to the prophet, it keeps on reiterating that, you know, you're a mere warner, you are a person, you are, your life is not to be elevated into a miracle worker. And there was a lot of suspicion about stories of the prophet because they didn't want to create another gospel. But people being people, they desperately wanted to know about the prophet's life. And so when people came to write stories about them, they used the models of the prophets that came before him to develop stories. Now, how much is true and how much is untrue, how much was made up by people and how much was not, is a question that I think is almost impossible to answer.
I have a final question, which is, I always feel odd just picking one thing to ask people because they have multiple layered identities. But as we've spoken a lot about Islam, as someone who thinks about Islam, what would you like in public conversations, those who are not Muslim, to understand better or to do or stop doing? And the same for Muslims. Are there things that they do in public debates or public conversations that you think, yes, more of that, or please stop doing that?
Well, I was reading John Henry Newman's Present Position of Catholics in England. Bedtime reading, I'm sure it is for you as well. But it's a fascinating book because he's defending Catholicism against what he describes as, you know, the farrago of misunderstandings. People read one book, maybe two books about Islam, they've got it, they understand it. And he was talking about Catholicism in that sense. But it's the same thing now. I mean, I would just ask people not to believe the first thing that somebody who presents themselves as a community leader or representative or Muslim says. I would ask them not just to read one book or two books or five books or even 10 books, but to read a lot more than that. I would ask people not to be so quick in their assumptions about what words mean and how that means. Madrasa doesn't necessarily mean what you think it means.
It's not terrorist school.
Fatwa doesn't mean what you think it means. A legal opinion, which may, but in most cases has nothing to do with sentences of death. As for Muslims, I don't know. I mean, we are already having all these conversations, but we tend to have them in private because the thought is that if we expose them to public view, then look, we've got to keep a united front because we're under pressure and people are always asking us questions, and then we need to have settled answers to them. I don't think being afraid of being questioning, not being afraid of having a sense of humour about ourselves. There's something quite humorous about the British Muslim situation, which I try and exploit, hopefully in good taste in the book. The idea that, you're this sort of weird hybrid kind of person. It's fine to be that because we always were hybrids in some ways at some point. I would ask, there's a rich heritage from 632 to 2019, and that is part of your identity and interpretation as well. Yeah. And if you think you're going back to the originary points, if you think you can come up with a literal interpretation, there is no such thing as a literal interpretation. You're just using somebody else's interpretation before you. We live in modernity and we are shaped as much by that as by anything. But there's a lot of richness in the pre-modern Islamic past, and that's what I would urge others to explore.
Samir Rahim, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Nate Bethay, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at @sacred_podcast, or me at @TheosElizabeth, or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take the sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.